Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 1400 hours GMT on Wednesday the 31st of January, these are our main stories. In Thailand, the opposition pro-democracy party Move Forward could be forced to dissolve following a court ruling.
The way the court has ruled, in effect, snuffs out any chance of debate about the law.
More than a dozen UN aid organisations urge donor countries to restore funding for the relief agency for Palestinians in Gaza. The former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, has been given another jail term. This time he's been sentenced to 14 years in prison. Also in this podcast, in France...
If we need to go to Brussels tomorrow and create a European movement, we'll do it.
The farmers' protest continues. In Thailand, a constitutional court ruling could have profound implications for the country's politics. Nine judges have decided that a plan by the country's most popular party to amend a law imposing severe punishments for speaking out against the royal family is tantamount to overthrowing the democratic regime of government. Last year's election was won by the opposition Move Forward party on a progressive platform, which included a proposal to change the country's strict lèse majesté law. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head told me more.
Well, I think there's two important implications. I mean, one is obviously for the party Move Forward, having been found to have violated the constitution. In fact, the Move Forward leader, Peter Lim Jerenrat, described it as being accused of treason in his response to it. The party is now very vulnerable to a move from a conservative or anyone in the authorities to have it dissolved. The courts in Thailand have huge powers to dissolve parties, to sack governments, and it's happened before it happened to the previous incarnation of Move Forward. So there's a lot of concern that that might happen, despite its immense electoral success last year. The other implication is over what can or cannot be said about the monarchy. I mean, the monarchy is very strictly protected in Thailand, and everyone knows it's a sensitive subject, and the lèse majesté law has always prevented any really negative comment about it. But the court appears to be saying you can't even talk about the law itself. Move Forward felt it was a legitimate subject to talk about in its election campaign because it's a law, it's passed by Parliament, it's widely viewed as too harsh, and the party argued that when in Parliament, we will propose amending it. The court has said you can't do that, at least not the way you've been doing it. You cannot have a discussion, you can't have public debate about it. It really means that not just the monarchy, but the law that protects the monarchy have become untouchable. And the Move Forward party has in its response raised this as a serious concern, saying it will actually make the monarchy more of a topic of controversial discussions. It might create clashes between the courts and the parliament. They see all sorts of problems coming out of this ruling.
And you talk about problems coming out of this ruling. I mean, has anyone come out onto the streets to protest? Because we have seen student protests in Thailand before.
Yes, of course. I mean, there's a lot of history here because when Move Forward's previous incarnation, Future Forward, was also dissolved by the courts, also after having done very well in an election 4 years ago, that was what sparked off the biggest protests we've seen on which involved this issue. Young youth-led protests where the discussion about the monarchy was unprecedentedly open and bold. Now, I don't think we'll see the same thing this time. The time is different, the public mood is different, but also the leaders of those protests 4 years ago are themselves now on trial for lèse majesté, some of them facing multiple criminal charges, many of them in jail. In effect, the leadership of that movement has been crushed, and I think people will think twice before going out onto the streets over this issue, as they did in the past, given the risks that the law can be used so effectively against them. But it will lead to a lingering public dissatisfaction with Thailand's political system, where the choice of the electorate, remember, far more people voted for Move Forward than any other party in last year's election, with that policy platform of saying we want to change the royal defamation law. And now the courts are saying, well, whatever you vote for, we're not going to allow it. And I think that's going to lead to quite a lot of disillusionment. And of course, what it could do is lead to even greater popularity for Move Forward or whatever party succeeds it if the party is now dissolved.
Jonathan Head. We cannot abandon the people. That's the plea from United Nations aid agencies who want donations resumed to fund the main humanitarian organization in Gaza. Countries, including the US, UK and Germany, have paused their funding of the UN's Palestinian refugee agency, UNRWA, after allegations that some of its staff were involved in the Hamas attacks in Israel last October. In a statement, the heads of all UN aid agencies insisted any employees involved will be held accountable, but said stopping financial support to UNRWA will have catastrophic consequences for the more than 2 million people dependent on aid. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Nick Beek, has more.
We've had a joint statement from the various bosses of the United Nations agencies, and they've described the allegations against some members of staff as being horrifying. The allegation that's come from Israel that some members of the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees were actually involved in the Hamas attacks of October the 7th. But at the same time, these senior United Nations officials are saying that the whole organization shouldn't be punished for that. And that is because they say that they're the only organization that is in a position to help the 2 million Palestinians in Gaza who they say desperately need assistance, whether that's healthcare, food, getting supplies of fuel to them. Of course, Israel says that the evidence it's put forward suggests that UNRWA shouldn't have any role in the future in Gaza, that it's simply not fit for purpose. It's pretty complicated, this. If you look at what's happening with the United States, America's saying that UNRWA is the only organization that is able to look after people. But of course, it is the biggest donor, the United States. It has for now suspended its funding. So a very difficult situation. Top UN officials warning of catastrophe if the funding isn't extended. And they're saying that they'll have to cease their operations after the end of February if no more cash comes through.
Nick Beek in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, there's little sign of an end to the war, with Israel reporting clashes in northern Gaza and ongoing fighting in the rest of the Strip. The violence has been tearing families apart and creating thousands of orphans. According to a recent report from Euromed Human Rights Monitor, more than 24,000 children have lost one or both parents. In the chaos caused by the conflict, medics and rescuers often struggle to find carers for bereaved children. Our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell has been finding out more, and parts of her report are distressing.
Her vital signs are good, but born amid the horrors of Gaza's war, the wide-eyed, month-old baby in an incubator has never known a parent's hug. She was delivered by C-section after her mother, Hannah, was crushed in an Israeli airstrike.
She's called Hannah Abu Amsha's daughter.
Hannah died before she could name her child. The nurse, Warda Alauda, explains at Adira Bala Hospital.
We've lost connection with her relatives. Nobody came. Her mother was killed, and we don't know what happened to her father.
Over 3 months of relentless Israeli bombardment haven't spared the youngest Gazans. Israel says it tries to avoid hurting civilians, but more than 11,000 children have reportedly been killed. Many more have seen their families wrenched away. Ibrahim Abu Mus, just 10, is being treated for leg and stomach injuries caused when a missile hit his home. But his tears are for his dead mum, grandpa and sister. They kept telling me they were being treated upstairs in the hospital, he says. But I found out the truth when I saw photos on my dad's phone. I cried so much that I hurt all over. By the sandy graves of their relatives in a school-turned-shelter, the cousins of the Hussein family sit together in trauma and grief. Each has lost one or both parents. The bomb fell on my mum's lap, Abid says. It took us days to take all her body parts from the rubble of the house. Every day is hard. It's not nice. There's no water, food or drink, says Kinza Hussein. Everything's sad. All Gazans now strive to find safety and rely on aid handouts for the basics of life. But the UN's Children's Agency says its biggest concern is for an estimated 19,000 children who are orphaned or have ended up alone with no adult to look after them. Some are sole survivors of bombings. Others have been found at Israeli checkpoints, in hospitals or on the streets. Jonathan Crick, the communications chief for UNICEF Palestine, is in Rafah.
For the youngest one, they very often cannot even say their name. And even the older one, they are usually in shock. When the extended family can be found, they also have their own children. So sometimes it's difficult, if not impossible, for them to take care of those unaccompanied and separated children.
With their lives shattered, UNICEF says nearly all of Gaza's children need mental health support. And even when the war's over, many will be left with terrible losses that they'll struggle to overcome.
Yolan Nell on the bereaved children of Gaza. The former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, has been given another long prison sentence, this time alongside his wife, Bushra. The pair have been convicted of buying state gifts worth more than $500,000 at an undervalued price whilst he was in office. Now, the courts have sentenced Imran Khan to a further 14 years in jail after he was given a 10-year jail sentence for leaking state secrets on Tuesday. These sentences will run at the same time. I spoke to our correspondent Caroline Davis in Islamabad and asked her what this latest sentence involves.
So this particular case today was referred to as the Tosha Khanna case. Now, this is the accusation that Imran Khan and his wife, Bushra Bibi, purchased items including a jewellery set, a watch, a pen. These were state gifts that had been given to Pakistan. Politicians here are able to purchase those items, but the accusation is that Imran Khan and Bushra Bibi purchased them at an undervalued price, therefore kept those items after that time, even after he had left office as well. And now, as a result of this conviction that was brought by the anti-corruption unit here in Pakistan, they have been sentenced to 14 years in prison each. They've also been told they have to pay a fine of over 1.5 billion rupees between them, and they have both been barred from holding public office for 10 years.
We should say, shouldn't we, that they both deny all the accusations, and will they now appeal?
Their lawyers have been pretty adamant that they will appeal against these charges. The lawyers themselves said that they weren't, in fact, inside court. In fact, when the court hearing happened, only journalists and the judge were inside court. Both Bushra Bibi and Imran Khan were not in court to hear their sentencing. This was all done inside the Adiyala jail on the outskirts of Rawalpindi, not far away from where I am in Islamabad. And that's because Imran Khan has been in jail behind bars since August of last year. And so all of the court proceedings for this case have been heard while he's been inside those jail facilities. The lawyers then turned up shortly afterwards and said that they were told by the media of what happened inside that court case. We've asked the Justice Ministry for further information about exactly what happened there. But the lawyers made it very clear that they think that this is not a fair procedure of justice. They have referred to the whole proceedings as being a kangaroo court and have said that they are planning to appeal against this decision.
And of course, Caroline, elections are coming up, what, in less than 2 weeks in Pakistan. So what impact is all this having, all this to do with Imran Khan? What sort of impact is it having on the voters?
So it is a week and one day until the general elections start here in Pakistan. Imran Khan had already been disqualified from running in those elections, so this doesn't change anything directly for him. But the suggestion has been by political analysts, does this change the calculation for voters? Now, Imran Khan's party, the PTI, had their symbol of the cricket bat removed from them by the Electoral Commission here in Pakistan. They are running as independents, but are quite clearly backed by the party, by the PTI. So now are we going to see a drop in morale from both those candidates and from the supporters, from the voters who feel, well, Imran Khan is not coming out of prison anytime soon. There's no point in voting for a party that he founded. Or are we going to see the counter effect? Are we going to suddenly see a boost in the number of voters turning out for the PTI-backed candidates? We don't know yet, and that will all reveal itself on the 8th of February next week.
Caroline Davis in Pakistan. In France, protests by angry farmers are continuing, with motorways blocked and slow-moving convoys of tractors causing traffic jams on key routes into Paris. The farmers are demonstrating about a range of issues, including rising costs, fuel prices, inflation, bureaucracy, and Ukrainian grain imports. The demonstrations in France follow similar action in other European countries, including Germany and the Netherlands. Bethany Bell has been talking to a French dairy farmer who's taking part.
Arnaud Besset feeds his calves at his farm north of Paris. Six generations of his family have farmed this land, but he's worried there may not be a future here for his 15-year-old son.
We have lost a third of our dairy farms in France in 20 years. It's a reality, an inevitability, and it continues. It's a tidal wave. Today, I'm losing all my neighbours, whether they have small or big farms.
Arnaud says there's too much regulation and too little money. His anger has spurred him to join the protests. His tractor is now one of hundreds blocking one of the major motorways to Paris. The protests have blown up into a huge crisis for France's new Prime Minister, Gabriel Attal. But in a speech to the National Assembly, he said his government was ready to find answers.
I say it here solemnly, there is and there must be an exception for French agriculture. I see clearly that faced with all the red tape, faced with decisions dictated from whoever knows where, farmers are confused and are waiting for answers and solutions.
France's leader, President Emmanuel Macron, is going to meet the head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, in Brussels on Thursday. He's called for reform, but also defended the EU.
Without the common agricultural policy, our farmers would have no income. For many of them, they wouldn't be able to earn a living. So I hear a lot of things, but we need to set the record straight. We have a strong European policy that enables us to provide very substantial support to our farmers' incomes.
But out on the motorway, Arnaud says he's willing to take the fight all the way to Brussels.
If we need to go to Brussels tomorrow and create a European movement, we'll do it.
Farmer Arnaud Besset. And now, a quick request from Oliver Conway.
Thanks, Val. Yes, we need your help to make a special edition of the Global News podcast to mark the second anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February. We'll be joining forces with the experts at the BBC's Ukraine cast to answer your questions about where the war goes from here. So if you want to know whether people in Ukraine still want to fight, or if ordinary Russians are beginning to turn against the special military operation, or anything else, then please email us, and if possible, record a voice note so we can play it out in the podcast. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or you can tweet us on X at Global News Pod.
Thanks, Ollie. Still to come.
Both sides have dug in a Goliath versus Goliath battle, potentially with an eye on setting a precedent as the industry does develop more.
An app that's launched the career of many recording artists, but now TikTok faces the wrath of a global music corporation. And let's take a trip to the West Side to remember one of Broadway's shining stars. We look at the life of Chita Rivera, who's died at the age of 91. Leaders of big tech companies like Meta, X and TikTok are being questioned by a US congressional committee amid accusations of exploitation and abuse of children who use their platforms. There's huge concern that children are not being protected from sexual predators and bullying and are getting access online to pornography and information about self-harm. Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, told us some tech bosses were even reluctant to attend the hearing.
Some of them have actually had to be subpoenaed because they didn't want to come. So Linda Yaccarino from X, Jason Citrin, who's from Discord, and Evan Spiegel, who's from Snapchat, none of them volunteered to be there. I think it's going to be a pretty robust and long hearing. When we've seen these sort of things in the past, the senators really don't hold back. There's a lot of anger, I think, and upset about the impact of some of the services on children's safety and mental health. But I also think that actually the senators and the lawmakers need to take some responsibility here too, particularly in the US, where they've talked about this for so long and there's been lots of legislation that's been discussed, but not much of it has actually got very far.
I suppose a lot of people listening to this will think, well, how much is this a parent's responsibility to make sure their child is safe online, and how much is it to do with the actual tech companies?
I think that really is the million-dollar question, isn't it? I mean, obviously, as a parent, you want to look after your children. You want to be as proactive as you can in safeguarding them. On the other hand, we've got these incredible communities that have sprung up. You know, we know about the benefits that many people get from being online, and it is the world in which our children are growing up in. So it's how to get that balance between letting them explore it and trying to keep them safe. On the other hand, the tech companies have created these platforms in the first place, and actually, should the bulk of the responsibility be on them? There is no clear answer. I think what we'll hear in Senate today is the tech companies trying to put forward everything they're doing, and senators saying, well, it's not enough, is it?
And do you think anything is going to change from this?
Well, we know that there's some legislation that is getting a bit closer to the finish line, and perhaps we will see that. I know that there's a lot of cynicism, that what we'll hear is a lot of talk and a lot of drama, and it will be dramatic. I'm sure there'll be lots of theatre. And these are, you know, very powerful figures that we don't see very often in public. So everyone will be very interested in what these tech bosses have to say. But ultimately, is it going to bring about a change? The US is in election year. There are so many priorities. This could potentially be a big vote winner, couldn't it, in terms of being able to bring something in that feels constructive and future-proofed and helpful. But as we've seen in the UK, it's very hard to do.
Zoe Kleinman. And now, is TikTok about to change forever? You got that dream, dream,
look in your eye. I remember when we broke up, the first time saying this is it, I've had enough, because like we hadn't seen each other in a month.
Just some of the tens of millions of clips on TikTok using Taylor Swift music for dances, acting skits, and even running along the beach. But Taylor Swift is a universal music artist, and Universal is now saying TikTok needs to stop using music from anyone on their books or pay up. Stephanie Prentice told Davina Gupta what's going on.
This is a good old-fashioned fight over cash. So Universal Music, they're going back and forth with TikTok over getting paid for their artists. That includes Taylor Swift, Drake, Adele, Harry Styles, all hugely popular with TikTok demographics. And Universal has laid out its argument in an open letter. It says there are three critical issues causing the breakdown of this negotiation. One is pretty obvious, so getting paid for artists and songwriters, then protection from what it calls the harmful effects of AI, and also online safety. Where it gets more sticky seems to be the alleged tactics used. So Universal claim that TikTok attempts to give them a worse deal than the one they currently have, then met their request to negotiate with what the letter calls indifference, then intimidation. It says TikTok tried to bully them by saying it would remove the music of developing artists, so those smaller artists the Universal wants to promote, and just keep those global big hitters. TikTok refute all of this. It says Universal is putting greed above the interests of their artists by walking away from this platform that could put them in front of billions of users globally every day.
And the clock is ticking, because it seems that this arrangement is going to come to an end very soon.
Yep, it expires today, so the clock is definitely ticking. Let's take a quick listen to Mark Mulligan. He works for Media Research and he's a music analyst.
There are billions of dollars of worth of royalties out there, but not that much of it is currently on social media. Most of those royalties are on streaming services like Spotify, etc. We're beginning to see the rise of social media as being something, a completely different part of the music business. TikTok thinks it is more valuable to, you know, Universal's getting more value out of it by promoting its artists, and Universal thinks TikTok's getting more value out of its artists. So we are, this is really sort of a growing pain of a new sector of the business.
So as we heard there, right now, both sides have dug in a Goliath versus Goliath battle, potentially with an eye on setting a precedent as the industry does develop more towards those socials. So it will be really interesting to see how it plays out today and into tomorrow.
Stephanie Prentice. A two-year-old boy from Glasgow in Scotland is thought to be the youngest person ever to reach Everest Base Camp. That's about 5,364 metres above sea level. Young Carter Dallas completed the trek with his mum and dad, Jade and Ross Dallas, who are on a year-long trip around Asia.
For the first 2 days, Jade carried him and I had all our luggage, which was a lot heavier than Carter, so... After 2 days, we arranged a porter, so I would then take Carter and the porter would take the bags.
And was there anything you were concerned about, like altitude sickness, that sort of thing?
We were always aware of the possibility, so we'd agreed from the beginning if there was any signs of altitude sickness, we would happily just call it a day and turn back. But we were absolutely fine, and Carter had the checks on the way. He actually grew in confidence and got stronger, more energetic as we actually got a wee bit more tired.
And that moment when you get that moment of triumph, presumably Carter didn't entirely share it. I mean, did he realise why mum and dad were so excited?
He would see us celebrating and he was just jumping about, having the biggest smile on his face and enjoyed it in the fun.
Carter is very much, he likes to get involved in whatever's going on. You know, we encourage him to participate in everything and anything. And that's why we thought, we'll try Everest Base Camp. This wasn't to prove anything to anyone. We simply done this because as a family, we felt it was right for us.
And you will have some incredible photos, some incredible memories, I guess.
One thing we had read, we knew there was going to be some controversy, is people saying that Carter will never remember it. I think it's a bit of a silly statement because for us, it's about living in the moment. It's not about Carter remembering it or not. If that was the case, you wouldn't do anything with your child. It's a special opportunity that we have, getting to take a year away from our work and travel.
And that was Ross and Jay Dallas speaking there to James Copnell. Now to one of the greatest songs in one of the greatest musicals. The song America from the famous musical West Side Story. And we're playing it because Chita Rivera, one of Broadway's most celebrated stars, has died at the age of 91. Chita Rivera will forever be linked to the original stage role of key cast member Anita and would see her career span a near 7 decades of singing, dancing and acting. Chita Rivera's daughter, Lisa Mordente, released a statement saying her mother had died peacefully in New York after a brief illness. Of mixed Puerto Rican and Scottish-Irish heritage, Chita Rivera was regarded as a trailblazer for Latina women in the arts and seen by many as a true Broadway legend. Toni Basil, a friend of Chita Rivera's and a US singer, actress and choreographer in her own right, spoke to the BBC's Victoria Uwankunda about Chita's legacy.
I met her in 1963. I had just gotten out of high school. I'd come to Los Angeles and I auditioned for the Broadway show, which they were remounting with almost the complete original cast of West Side Story, which I'm not sure if your audience knows. I know they know of the Anita in West Side Story, but Rita Moreno won the Oscar for it. Ariana DeBoss won the Oscar for it. Chita did the original Broadway show, that character. And when they remounted it in Los Angeles, which was after the Broadway show closed, after the movie premiered, they remounted it with almost a complete original cast. And she was Chita Rivera, and she was doing the role that she originated, Anita, in West Side Story. And I got to be in the same show as Chita Rivera, and I used to stand on the side of the stage in the wings and watch every move she made, everything she did. She was so phenomenal.
You happen to have been one of the many people who shared the stage with her, who was in her presence working together. What made her stand out?
Well, she was just a unique, dynamic talent. She was, her persona was unique. There was no one like her. I was lucky enough to do the show again. This time I auditioned for Anita in West Side Story, and I got the role. And when somebody, I did it in San Diego with a small company, and when people say, oh, I made the role my own. No, I did not make the role my own. I imitated every morsel of what I saw Cheetah do on the stage. I think I said the lines the same. I tried to dance the same. I wore my hair the same. I did everything the same as Cheetah. I figured, you know, she got it right. And why? I better try to just imitate her so I get it right. I know that I say she was an actress, a singer, and a dancer, but her style of performance and as a performer, she was so dynamic. And dancers just, they always stay somehow emotionally in touch. It's physical. As a singer, you know, we can all sing in the bathroom and echo. You know, we don't need to go to a studio. We can sing. With acting, you kind of read your lines and you learn them at home. But with dancing, you need that big room and you need that dance floor and you need to get there to that studio. And there's something about the journey that we all have in common. And when I say it keeps you grounded, it keeps you grounded. It keeps you humble. And she was always so wonderful and humble. And she was just an extraordinary person.
And that was Tony Basil on Cheetah Rivera, who's died at the age of 91. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, and you can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Joe McCartney. The producer was Olivia Oteba. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.